accounting is notoriously painful, notoriously tedious. People hate it. There's so many games that are based around money and transactions. Monopoly, most famously. We can play these games and we love these games, but when it comes to our actual finances, then we really struggle.
How would you describe what you do with your days today?
Yeah. Awesome. So
Philip Fierlinger, co-founder of Xero, helped grow it into a billion-dollar company through innovative design.
Now co-CEO of Upstock, he leads change in the food service industry and advises startups on growth and strategy.
The hardest part is getting in someone's head and trying to figure out how they're thinking. And I went through that process with this prototype. We got up to the part where they were matching their transactions and they were like, wait a second, are you kidding me? Are these two transactions, they're automatically matched and all I have to do is click OK? Okay. And you're like, holy shit.
What was that turning point?
There were a couple moments where, you know, it became clear to me that this was going to be big. And one of them was...
What's up, guys? Today, we are in for a genuine treat. This has been one of the most interesting chats for me personally on the pod. The guest is Philip Fierlinger. He is the co-founder of Xero. Wow, there's just so much in this. There is no accounting for experience, pardon the pun. You know, Philip is from the United States, originally worked in, you know, Silicon Valley, migrated to New Zealand for reasons which he explained at the very end of this podcast. There are some incredible stories embedded in this pod that really are the secrets behind how him and his co-founders built Xero to a 25 billion dollar company out of New Zealand, and also what he's doing now with his latest startup, why he's in New Zealand, what success is, what it takes, how you achieve it. It is an extraordinary interview. I think you guys are going to love it. Make sure you like, subscribe, drop a comment. Enjoy. What's up, everybody? Welcome to this episode of Unemployable. We have an epic session ahead of us here with one of New Zealand's, and well, he's American, but resides in beautiful New Zealand, one of the most successful companies to come out of this region of the world, co-founder of Xero, and doing a whole bunch of other really, really interesting stuff. For those of you who live under a rock, Xero is one of the most successful accounting softwares in the world with a $25 billion market cap thereabouts, give or take, and they found a way to make it cool and interesting and fun to do accounting. So we're going to jump in today with Philip Fierlinger. Welcome to the show, Philip. How are you?
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
So people are going to ask, where are you hailing? Are you astral camera? You're in Hawke's Bay right now in New Zealand?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I was in Wellington for quite a few years and then recently transplanted to Hawke's Bay and absolutely loving it here in heaven.
It's a beautiful part of the world, isn't it, New Zealand? And you originally from San Francisco, you were saying, the Bay Area?
Yeah, that's right. And I grew up on the East Coast as well.
Yeah, terrific. What part of the East Coast were you?
Philly.
Philly. In the house. Love it.
76ers fan.
Sorry, say that again?
Are you a 76ers fan?
76ers fan. You know what? I'm not, like, people ask me a lot about sports. You know, the only sports that I really like is surfing and skiing. I'll watch a game. So yeah, the 76ers, Dr. J, you know, I remember kind of the heyday, but no, I don't follow it.
Yeah. So Philip, just in a nutshell, we'll go back to the Xero story in a minute, but how would you describe what you do with your days today? Like a snapshot into your life today. Obviously, Xero's behind you now. You're doing a whole bunch of other stuff. Let's sort of get with where you are today and then we'll dive back in time and find out how you got there.
Yeah. Awesome. So I've got a new venture called Upstock, which is a B2B e-commerce and marketplace platform for FMCG brands. So that's food and beverage brands that wholesale to their buyers, and their buyers can be hospitality, distributors, and grocery supermarkets. So it's that, you know, trade, wholesale trading between trading partners, buyers and suppliers. And what's interesting about that is that, you know, the way I got into it and when I got into it, but, you know, we can dive into that in a minute. But in terms of my day to day, it's really, you know, setting the strategy, both on the marketing and product side, which is, you know, a lot of what I did at Xero. And then, you know, setting also the business strategy. So I have a co-founder. We met and we, you know, really connected and collaborated really well at Xero. So Duncan Ritchie and he was chief platform officer at Xero, among, you know, various other titles that he had while he was there. And so we co-founded the business together with Matt Watson, who was kind of the originator of the whole idea and the whole platform. And so he owns an iconic soft drinks brand called Fox and Fizz. And so it's like this Kiwiana brand that's been around forever. And he had this problem where he was getting wholesale orders in all kinds of random ways. So he'd get texts in the middle of the night and phone calls in the middle of the night, and he'd forget to write them down, or he wrote them down wrong. He either didn't understand them or he was half asleep, that kind of thing. So a lot of things fell through the cracks, and it caused a lot of friction in his relationship with his customers. And so he was losing money, losing orders, and, you know, having all kinds of problems with his customers. So he thought, you know, there must be a better way in software. There must be a software solution that can fix this. And so he put something together, and it transformed his business. And that's when he approached me. And so when he approached me, I thought, well, this sounds a lot like, you know, marketplace and e-commerce, and that those things are, you know, really well established. There's e-commerce for everything today. I can't understand how he's having any problems. I'm just going to find some platform that will do the job. He just might not have found something. And so when I started searching, I was just astonished that there really isn't anything. So e-commerce and marketplaces, you know, are well established on the B2C side for consumers and retail. But on the B2B side, it is just, you know, the dark ages, really. It's medieval. There's still, you know, I was going into these businesses and they're writing things down on, day planners and scribbling notes about all their orders that they were coming in, because they'd get it in text and they get emails and they get phone calls. And so to consolidate it all, they were, you know, the fastest way they could do it was on a piece of paper. And you can imagine all the screw-ups that would happen when you just scribble some notes on a piece of paper, and just, you can't search pieces of paper. You can't, you know, there is no data really to work with and manage. So turning all of that digital, you know, was the first step. So immediately when, you know, I saw this, I realized, holy shit, I confirmed it across, it wasn't just food and beverage. You know, I went to a couple other types of businesses and confirmed they're operating the same way. And so B2B is this just untapped opportunity, and it is 100% inevitable. It's all going to go digital. So, you know, I was really fired up when I saw that. And I wasn't, you know, so it's interesting, like, you know, in terms of what I do day to day and, you know, getting from Xero to this, in between when I left Xero, I was really toasted. I was burnt the hell out. I had pretty severe PTSD. And, you know, I pretty much swore to myself, I'm never going all in again. Like that, you know, the startup thing is just too all consuming. It just, you know, I didn't have to do it. And, you know, just didn't really have an appetite at that point to do it. And then to find myself back in it again. And, you know, there's definitely lessons I've learned, that ways I want to do it that are different this time around. And, you know, I've been able to apply those lessons, and it's still fucking hard. No, you know, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. Like, there's still plenty of stress. And, you know, there's definitely sleepless nights and all that, but the passion and love for what I'm doing is, you know, the motivator. So, you know, the passion for the team that we have, for the customers we have, and the way that it's transforming their businesses and their lives, that's the rocket fuel that keeps me going and makes me love it. And this product that we're putting out in the world that, you know, I consider the best on the planet, and, you know, that it's really innovative and revolutionary in many ways. And so all that's super, super exciting, but it's still, you know, it is all consuming. And that is, you know, that's the hardest part about it, is, you know, trying to take a break and, you know, get some perspective and have a life at the same time is, you know, the challenging thing about running a startup.
What I take, there's a bunch I want to unpack here, and I just want to give people context, and correct me if I'm wrong. You were at Xero from 2006 to 2015, so it's a 9-year journey where you grew it from three guys or four guys or something So a $25 billion business, and you said you were burned out. I think that would be completely reasonable given the trajectory of that business. But what I take from that at a high level is that even a guy like you that has actually built something to that level, which is super, super rare, it still finds a startup really, really tough and hard. They are hard no matter whether you've done it before and had a multi-billion dollar success or you're just still trying to get your first $1 million business. Starting businesses is tough, especially in small countries and markets and trying to break through. So I hope our listeners don't miss that. Don't feel bad if you're stressed out trying to build a startup. It's no different even when you're someone like Philip who's had huge success. For those, just to be clear, if you want to check the website out, it's upstock.app, A-P-P. But essentially, Philip, what it does, just to make sure that before we journey too far down that road, people really understand. So if I'm running a restaurant or I'm running a bar, instead of like calling up the chef goes, can you order me, 15 steaks and we need 50 more bottles of fizz and we need this and that. Instead of like somebody running around with a phone and the notebook and like they're taking an order at a table, they just open Upstock. It's all their supplies are there. They just digitally add to one cart what they want and it automatically orders all those goods that they might need for the day or the week in one shopping cart from multiple suppliers for that industry. Is that correct?
Are you available for a copywriting job?
I need that.
Yeah, because I can imagine that is a huge problem in that industry, right? And I can see why you would have got excited about that. So,
and it's also on the grocery side as well. So if you can imagine, so a hospitality outfit would be stocking, let's say, 10 to 20 different suppliers, products from 10 different suppliers. But a grocery store would have, minimum 100, oftentimes many hundreds. And so the operational efficiency they could get by streamlining all that and automating all of that is absolutely, fundamentally game changing to their operation. And for grocery stores, those operations are really all about, getting things on shelves and then getting them off shelves and replenishing. So that is their whole business.
When people sort of think of you today, I'm sure you'll never get away from being the co-founder of Xero, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's incredible. But I imagine you as a human being have changed quite a bit in 18 years. Back then, would you say that you were principally a designer who wanted to work on an interesting startup? Because today, everyone would probably think of you as a successful tech founder. But really, from what I've read about you, you kind of bought the design. It's sort of like Airbnb got massive breakthrough because their attention to aesthetic and user experience, it's just not something that, aside from Apple, where there's a light really shone on the economic enterprise value that gets added. Because Xero, I mean, no offense, but you couldn't have chosen a more boring piece of soft space,
yeah,
right? Like accountants and industries, and you made it beautiful. And how much can you talk to us about that journey? Like, when there was you and Rod and the other co-founders, was that your role? Like, they're like, dude, make this thing beautiful, make this user interface exceptional, and you've won awards for it and all sorts of stuff. Can you talk us through the value then and now?
Yeah, no, and I really, really appreciate that. I'm glad you recognize that. A lot of people, don't necessarily recognize those things. I'll take it back from, when I was a kid starting out really in university, that I was always thinking about tools and, what I wanted in my life and basically inventing the future. Like, that's kind of, something that I've done throughout my life and throughout my career and just felt that I was able to see things before they happened and, was able to dream them up and then kind of conceptualize. And that, that's basically what, one of the principal things that a designer does is prototypes an idea, so takes an idea and makes it into something that people can buy into and that they can believe, and they do it as a prototype. So it, as far as anyone is concerned, when they're looking at it, it seems real, it feels real, it acts real. And so then it all of a sudden gives people a path forward, how they can actually turn this idea into a reality. And And that's kind of, you know, been the pattern throughout my career. And so, you know, the way Xero came together was, I'd moved to New Zealand and I was working at this agency that was doing really innovative work, and they're an amazing team, and I learned heaps from them, and we were doing really, really exceptional work. But I had these friends that founded a startup called Flickr, and Flickr was one of the first social networks, and it was all about photography. It was the Instagram of its day, and it was absolutely groundbreaking, and really, it was, you know, kind of the first Web 2.0 platform, and it really established a new paradigm in doing SaaS. Like, you know, the word SaaS wasn't around at the time, but they were pretty much the pioneers of it. And that immediately gave me this inspiration to start building software, build a software company that I could actually distribute online. Up until then, you know, you really had to to build a software company required an enormous amount of capital, and there was hard investment that you really had to put into it. And it was years and years of work where, you know, when you're making something online, you can iterate live, and you can constantly update what you're working on rather than shipping CDs or diskettes or whatever the hell it was. And so, you know, that was this, you know, all of a sudden this door opened up into making some software. And so I came up with an idea for some software, peer-to-peer learning software that I wanted to do. And I was really struggling in New Zealand to find anyone in this space that was thinking, you know, in New Zealand at the time, it was lots of government kind of IT contractors and IT businesses that were really in support of government agencies. And so there wasn't really a startup community. There weren't startup companies. TradeMe was, you know, the kind of exception to the rule. And so they were a little bit of an example of a New Zealand startup, but there really wasn't much else than that. And so I was looking around, like, you know, who can I bounce this idea off of and kind of bring to the table and form a company with? And I found this blogger that was really prolific, and just everything he said struck a chord with me. And it was all about, you know, business and software and technology and design as well. And so I met up with him. We had lunch and we immediately hit it off. We were finishing each other's sentences. So we had a follow-up meeting, and, you know, he said, come back to me, you know, give me a pitch, put together a pitch deck, and, let's talk next time. So I came back, and by the way, this is Rod Drury, that was this prolific blogger. And, I came back with his pitch deck, and he said, oh, this is amazing. This is really, like, stunning, really well, you know, strategically makes a whole lot of sense. Now let me pitch you something, accounting 2.0 and, you know, web accounting. And, you know, there was no kind of hesitation. I was like, absolutely get it, because that was the one thing that I was really intimidated by in terms of, you know, forming a startup, was the finance side of it and dealing with the likes of QuickBooks or MYOB. You know, I've used those throughout my career and, you know, always got caught out. It was just, you know, a fight to use those platforms and to not just, you know, it was kind of, you know, the real problem with those platforms was that they were really about paying taxes, which was something I didn't want to put energy into and put my time and resources into. What I wanted was a platform that helped me run my business. And, you know, those platforms seem to just drag me down into just kind of the doldrums and the admin rather than actually helping me run my business. And I do remember at that, you know, I said, yep, I totally get it for the reasons I just explained. And I said, one thing that, you know, we'll need to do is get data from the banks. We'll need to pull down transactional data from the banks. And I think that's going to be a bit of a problem. because banks, you know, don't necessarily, aren't really open, are notoriously closed. And he said, this is New Zealand, mate. I can get a meeting with anyone tomorrow, any one of the banks, and we'll be sorted. And we pretty much did. That was exactly pretty much what happened, which was pretty epic. And so the, you know, the immediate things that came to my, so I parked my idea for a startup and we immediately got rolling with Xero. And, you know, exactly as you said, that, you know, accounting is notoriously painful, notoriously tedious. People hate it with a passion. It's the butt of every hack comedian's, you know, routine is something about accountants and how dull they are. And so that to me seemed like, well, hang on, you know, there's so many games that are based around money and transactions. Monopoly, most famously, is, you know, the most popular game in the world, and it's all about, you know, finances. And so why is it that we, and, you know, we can play these games and we love these games, but when it comes to our finances, actual finances, then we really struggle. And so there wasn't a term for it at the time, gamifying things, but that was the line of thinking that I had. And I wanted to apply game theory. You know, I was playing, there was a video game at the time. It was Lego Star Wars. And I don't know if you remember this, but it, like, you know, it was my favorite game in the whole world. And I had these kids, little kids, we would play it all the time. And it was a very collaborative game. And that was the other thing that we were thinking about, like that this, to really transform the industry, it needs to be a collaboration between an accountant and the small business owner. And that was something that, you know, for instance, MYOB is literally, their whole selling point is that you don't need an accountant, basically, that you can mind your own business. And same thing with Intuit, you know, that their selling point was you don't need an accountant. And we had a very different perspective, and we felt that you actually really do need an expert, but you need a better relationship with that expert. And again, there was a lot of friction in that relationship, and how do we remove that friction, give the small business owner and the accountant, you know, this real-time visibility of the finances, which will help them collaborate better. And so, you know, that Lego Star Wars game was on my mind a lot. And then I was really kind of struggling to figure out what is a metaphor for, like, you know, I didn't want to go too cyber and, like, try to make 3D environments. This is the web after all. So, you know, how do I design something that is, you know, that you can actually deliver over the web, but is playful and has a game like quality to it. And one day I was playing, you know, every day after I'd come home from work, my son would want to play this matching card game. I forget what it's called. But you basically have a deck of cards and it's matching pairs, and you put them all face down, and, you know, you flip one over, and then you have to find a match, or you flip them back. Once you find a match, then you take those off the deck. And as we were playing this game, the interesting thing about it was, like, that it's so easy to do. It's so easy to get excited about it. Like, even as an adult, and it's the simplest thing in the world, but you get, like, this endorphin high from finding a match. And it's because we're wired as humans to do pattern matching. And so, you know, and we're also competitive. So, like, that winning feeling is an instant high, and you feel, like, accomplished, and I've achieved something. And then I realized, actually, what we're doing is a bank reconciliation here. That, you know, one card is a transaction from the bank, and then the other card is the matching transaction in your accounting system. And once you make that match, you can take that pair off. That's a reconciled transaction. And if we can make it this magic experience where you just, like, okay, cool, that's a match, then, and it's one click, and I've done my bank reconciliation. And we, you know, in my research, when I was, you know, the first thing, you know, I knew I hated accounting, and that was about as much as I knew about accounting. You know, I knew invoices, but I didn't know the ins and outs and the particulars. And talking to accountants, bookkeepers, and business owners, cash flow was, you know, everything came back to cash flow, that a business lives or dies off cash flow, especially small to medium businesses are extra sensitive to it. And that bank reconciliation is the pinch point of of that cash flow. So when I did the analysis, most businesses were doing maybe one bank reconciliation a year. So they were 12 months in arrears. They didn't have any real-time visibility. And it was all just agonizing effort to get their books up to, you know, and if they're really good, maybe they're doing it, you know, every 6 months or every quarter. And like the rock stars, very, very few of them were doing it. The best you could do was once a month, because that's when your paper statement came in. And then you'd have to sit down with that paper statement and, you know, scribble on it and then type into the computer. And, you know, it was, nobody wanted to do it. And so people just would put it off. But all of a sudden, you know, so I had built a prototype to show people that, you know, was this matching game. And I showed it to Rod and Craig, who was the CTO. And I said to them, you know, I have this idea for how we can do cash flow and, you know, make this the core focus of the platform. And it's a bit edgy. You know, I don't know. I don't quite know what I'm doing here. So keen for your feedback. And they were like, yeah, this is really cool. But again, we're not sure that people will get it. Like, this is quite unusual and unconventional. And so I said, well, great. So I've already booked in user testing. So I'm going to bring in a bunch of people and we're going to test them. And so I brought people in and, you know, the first person sat down, and the way I do user testing, again, it's a prototype, it's faked, it's a dummied up, but people think it's kind of real. And so they're really immediately kind of drawn into it. And I said, you know, this is the way my method for doing user testing is, tell me, I give them the premise, you need to do a bank reconciliation. And I try to give them as little detail as possible so I'm not, you know, leading the witness. And I say, tell me everything that you see. So talk out loud, you know, as you're looking at the screen, tell me what you see. Then tell me what you want to do. And then tell me what you expect to happen when you do that, so that I'm getting inside their heads. You know, that's the hardest part, is getting in someone's head and trying to figure out how they're thinking, what they're thinking, and what they're expecting. And I went through that process and, you know, with this prototype, and it was really amazing that people were, you know, we got up to the part where they had to, like, you know, get the statement and start scribbling on the piece of paper. And they were like, kind of looking at their watches and really getting twitchy and angsty and wanting to go. And I said, just hang in there a second. Like, if you can just give us 5 more minutes. And we got up to the part where they were matching their transactions. And they were like, wait a second, are you kidding me? Are these two transactions, they're automatically matched? And all I have to do is click OK. And I, you know, as part of my user testing, I can't tell them anything. And I say, I don't know, you tell me. And they said, yeah, no, I think this is exactly like, okay, I want to click that button. And so you click the button and automatically matches the transaction. They were like, holy shit. And immediately we're saying, like, how much is this? When is this out? Like, I need this right now. I could use this today. And, you know, that was the first person. And I told Rod and Craig, I was like, that was amazing. I did not expect that. Maybe we got first time lucky. I have 6 more people coming in, so let's see how we go. And, you know, person after person had very, very similar experiences. So to me, it was just a smash success, kind of obvious, this is what we're doing. And both Rod and Craig were like, yeah, that's cute and that's cool, your little prototype here. But we have to actually build this. And if we're going to build this, then we can't build an account. It's either building this, what you've designed here, or building an accounting system. And what you've designed is too hard to build. And I was like, I mean, I do coding myself. And so I said, like, do you actually want me to code? This is not that hard to code. And that didn't go so well with the engineer, as you can imagine. You know, so it was just kind of like a lot of heat coming my way, but they insisted, like, no, we're not doing this. And so I ended up designing a conventional bank reconciliation that you had to wait for the statement at the end of the month, a piece of paper. We brought people in for user testing with this conventional design, conventional solution. That was the only option. And people had that exact, like, I'm not going to do this. Like, I'm not going to sit here and do this. Sorry. Like, this is a waste of my time. And the ones that would, you know, stick through it were making a mistake every time they would write something down. They'd write the wrong date down. They'd write the wrong amount down. They'd write the wrong business name down. And none of them said, hey, I want to sign up immediately. How much is this? You know, can I get going today? They all left like, all right, please never call me again kind of vibes. And so that was this moment, this defining moment for us with design at Xero, that, you know, technically speaking, you know, the underlying technology is not radically different, but the user experience is night and day difference. And that was, they realized that design is the key to making something that is going to get attention, that people will want, that people will get excited about, and that will change the industry. Otherwise, we weren't doing anything. We weren't really adding much to the industry. So that was this really, and that was in, you know, the first 2 months of starting Xero. And that immediately, already, you know, at that point, Craig was already engineering things. He was already coding things. And he said, I'm going to now stop and wait till you design something. Then I'll start engineering, coding, whatever you've designed. And again, that set this precedent that design leads everything.
Yeah.
Everything we do starts with design.
That's an extraordinary backstory. And thank you for sharing that. And I can see the look on Mark's face here. I was listening to another pod this morning on the way into the studio, and a billionaire investor was saying, this reminds me of a few quotes, I'll just say two of them. He said, what I look for, he says, I look for somebody, he said, when the Rolling Stones started playing rock and roll, they realized that, you know, the violin had already been done by Mozart and Beethoven, and that you need to learn to get a new sound. You need something new. That's what I'm looking for. And I'm also reminded of that famous Peter Thiel quote where he says, what do you know that really smart people in your industry don't know? And you're such a rare bird, Philip, because you're a designer, part coder, part entrepreneur, and you understand the basics of accounting. That's like a pretty rare find, because usually you see a designer and he's the guy in the, you know, the purple slippers and the, you know, like... You're sort of much more well-rounded. Mark, you were going to say something.
Yeah, a couple of things. It was incredible hearing you build up to that holy shit moment, like when people are sitting there going, holy shit. And from what I've read and learned about Apple's story, they were trying to basically design a portable like iPad. They were trying to design the iPad, and Steve Jobs came across inertia scrolling. And it was some other company that was working on that technology. And he basically said, let's drop everything, let's build a phone through that element. And I was just going to ask, like, how inspired were you by the story of Apple? Like, how did it all converge in that sense?
There's a great, actually connection to what you just described. So I went to university and studied industrial design. So there was no software design, you know, as a university course when, you know, I was a kid. And my first computer was an Apple computer. And that, you know, that was my first. I fell in love with computers at like 12 years old. And so that was, you know, one of my first kind of real experiences with technology and just having fun with this, the ability to build things to from nothing. You know, you go from nothing and you create something, and you're, you know, the god of this universe that you're creating, and you have to build every element of it. And that to me was just absolutely incredible. And so when I was in university, a lot of my projects, so, you know, industrial design is hardware design. And at the time, Sony was the consumer electronics giant, and every product that they made the Walkman, they made you know, these Trinitron TVs, and they made stereo systems that everyone just, you know, gushed over, and all these, you know, beautiful devices. And so that was kind of the high watermark for industrial design. And Apple was just then kind of emerging as a leading force in industrial design as well. Like their early industrial design was pretty clunky, but then they hired this design firm, Frog. And Frog was absolutely, again, just, you know, changed the rules about how you know, everything up until then was beige. And so they made everything this like crisp wipe, and they used typography in this really radical way. And they were playful in everything up, you know, again, Apple, even their marketing in the very early days was still, it was kind of confused, and it was like partially education, partially business. They didn't really know what they were, who they were targeting, and what they stood for. And then around the time that Frog got involved, they really started, you know, honing in on, and this is around the time the Macintosh also was released. And so I decided that I wanted to do an internship as part of my university, my last year final project at university. And so Sony was, you know, an obvious contender. And so I applied to, you know, do an internship at Sony. But then there was this stealth company that was out in Silicon Valley that rumors were, you know, if you knew the right magazines, because again, there was no internet at the time, so you had to do it all through magazines and kind of, you know, weird, you know, bulletin boards were the only kind of electronic way of finding, you know, news. And so there were some bulletin boards that, you know, my brother and I had one of the first modems that ever existed. And so we did have access to these bulletin boards where these rumors, you could read about this company that was emerging. And it was the original Macintosh team from Apple that was building, rumored to be building a mini device, like a little handheld computer. And that really, really got me fired up. And I also applied to Apple. And so interestingly, I got accepted to to General Magic, which was this company that's kind of that spun out of Apple, and to Sony. And so, you know, Sony was in New Jersey, Apple was in San Francisco, and I was like, yeah, I'm going to San Francisco, I'm going to Silicon Valley. And so I got to work with, you know, those people, the people that made the original Macintosh. And it was a pretty, pretty incredible experience. But it was also really fascinating because it was this dream team of engineers. And Susan Kerr was the original designer of the Mac UI and the Mac fonts and all that. And the first thing that they had me do when I got there was user testing on their device. So I sat down with this device, and I immediately was just screaming, cursing at it. I was like, fuck this. I hate this. What the hell? Why is this not working as expected? And like, why does it do this? This is, you know, I just had nothing nice to say about it. Because it was like this weird, like your interface to this product was through a fake Main Street, and you walk into a room, and then you open a drawer to get out your address book. So you had to do like 20 things to open. You just find a contact. You had to go through this goofy experience. And by the way, this is on really slow hardware. It's all like it's like doing it on a calculator. Imagine doing it on a calculator. So it was really eye opening. And they were like, you know, the guy who was doing the user testing with me, he was like, "Don't you know we're the gods of Silicon Valley? Like, you think this is dumb, but you know, this is not, we're going to be massively successful." So, and they weren't. There's actually a really awesome documentary called General Magic, the movie that details it. And so one of the people from that experience that I got to work with a fair bit was this guy called Tony Fidel, and he was a hardware engineer.
Hey guys, I hope you are enjoying this podcast. I just wanted to let you know that we are going to be opening Unemployable Coaching 2025 in mid-January. This is going to be a really exciting program next year. It's going to include all the amazing things you saw in the last year, private property tours, private training days, one-on-one coaching, and so much more. If you are interested in being notified when the program goes live, simply go to unemployable.com.au/coaching. That's unemployable.com.au/coaching. Put in your information, we'll let you know. With that said, let's get back to the pod.
And he and I would hang out a lot, and we'd kind of just roll our eyes a little bit at what they were doing. And so he ended up going to Apple, and he ended up being the lead engineer on originally the iPod and then the iPhone.
Wow.
And one of the things that I worked on when I was at General Magic was they were working on a tablet that was the size, you know, of a VHS. Again, half your audience probably don't know what the size of a VHS is, but about, you know, it was a big clunky thing. Like, you wouldn't want to really carry it around with you. And so I was imagining the 5-10 years out version that's, you know, a phone. And that was really, really amazing to design that. And that was the first time I'd heard the term cloud. We talked about the cloud. We talked about agents, that you would have these news agents that artificial intelligent agents that would go out, collect the news for you and bring it back. And what are the social impacts of that everyone has their own agent and they all get their own news. So it's amazing, again, to be able to see into the future. And so
what year is this?
1992.
Wow.
So 15 years before the iPhone. But it was inevitable, just like I said with Upstock, that, you know, this is 100% inevitable. This is going digital. This is all. And again, at that time, it was just really obvious that this is all going to happen. It's 100% inevitable. And part of the General Magic was an interesting collection of companies, the consumer electronics and software companies. So Apple was part of it. Panasonic was part of it. AT&T was part of it for the telecommunications side. And Sony was part of it. And the Sony team were actually there in the building. The rest of the other companies really didn't spend that much time. But I spent a good amount of time with the Sony team. And I said, this bullshit that they made is terrible. You guys are Sony. You made the Walkman. I want a digital Walkman. I want to be able to listen to any song, anytime, anywhere. And they just, you know, kind of patted me on the head and they said, that's cute, kid. And just kind of, you know, shooed me off. And so, you know, it's been interesting to be, you know, at the forefront of a lot of these things. And so I've had that experience over and over again. My next project was working with the Beastie Boys, and we worked on some VR stuff with them. And then we also, a lot of video stuff. And so, you know, it was kind of an early iteration of YouTube. And yeah, to be at the forefront of a lot of these things. But I also didn't, you know, make my fortunes doing those things. You know, I learned a valuable lesson that sometimes you can be too early. And so that was, you know, and also the same thing with a dream team. You can think, you can get really cocky and think that you have this team that can't be beaten and that they know everything. And actually that is their downfall, is that they think they know it all. So yeah, it's
a good place for listeners who want to learn more about some of this stuff. Like you mentioned, the Beastie Boys and your time at Xero is on your website, skyrise.com. I found that really interesting, diving into some of that stuff. And that's SKYRIZE, Z for zebra, skyrise.com. And you can read more and see some of these projects. So what a fascinating backstory, Philip. Like, so interesting, because I'm a massive fanboy of Macs, and I know what a beta tape is and a VHS tape. We're probably a similar age. I'm trying to explain. Recently, I was in Waiheke a few years ago, and I went past a one-hour photo shop. And you try explaining one-hour photography to a Gen Y or whatever it is. Like, hang on, how does it work? Like, this is a whole different world.
What I find amazing is how far out the present was created, right? Like, everything that we're seeing today with AI and agents is stuff that was happening around a garage or a boardroom back in 1992. Like, yep. Things sometimes, you know, like you said, you can be really early in this space as well. And sometimes things need time to come on.
I think for the listeners, there's immense value. Even if you're not in tech or software or hardware, but you're just a young entrepreneur listening to this, Philip has described twice here, user testing, seeing real human beings' reactions to your ideas. And I can just imagine you, Philip, watching them like a hawk at every click and being genuinely interested in their responses, not trying to seek confirmation, but rather information. And in the world we live in today, nobody really wants information. They just want confirmation that they're right, you know, that I want to be challenged. And so that is such a critical thing to do. I always say to people, when you're pitching your idea, really carefully watch the party on the other side of the table. Are they leaning forward? Are their eyes lighting up? Those subtle cues can mean the difference between 5 years of your life and all your life savings being completely wasted or turning into a zero. You know, and you know, you need somebody who's not genuinely not attached to being right, but is genuinely attached to solving a real problem, which I get a sense of with you. And it was an interesting pairing because Rod, I don't know much about Rod other than he's a front man, he's an entrepreneur. He'd sold out, I think, of a business for $50 million or something prior to founding Xero.
Yeah,
so he's probably more of a, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm just sort of guessing here. He's kind of like the front man. He's like the Steve Jobs.
Activator.
Yep. Whereas you're kind of like the other guy. What's
Johnny Ive.
Wozniak and Johnny Ive vibes. Yeah, I'm hearing here kind of a blend. You're kind of a Johnny Wozzy.
I really appreciate you actually highlighting that about user testing, because that is something that is, you know, near and dear to my heart and is to me is the secret to success. It was for Xero, like me spending that time. So when we founded Xero, as I mentioned, Craig immediately started coding, and I was baffled. I was like, what the hell are you coding? Like, we haven't even decided what we're working on. He's like, ah, it's a ledger. And I'm just, you know, building the database for the ledger. And, you know, I was like, okay, interesting. And then I was interviewing people. So I was interviewing accountants and bookkeepers and business owners. And, really quickly, both Craig and Rod were like looking at me with death stares and saying, mate, you know, why aren't you designing something? Like, you know, you should be making screens and making, you know, pretty pictures and all that. And I said, no, that's not what design is. Design is actually figuring out what's the right thing to do. What is it that we're actually building? What is the solution? So I would come back from each one of these sessions and I would, you know, go up with sticky notes on the wall. We were in this tiny, tiny little apartment. And I would just, anything that I found out that day. So, okay, so there's this thing called accounts receivables. And, you know, then that there's also fixed assets. And there's also blah, blah, blah. You know, and, you know, these are players. There's, you know, an account manager, or there's a comptroller. There's, you know, various players that are part of the workflow. So I was understanding the workflow, and I was mapping it out on the wall. I was like, we have all these things that come in. So these are inputs, and then they get output here. And so, and just moving sticky notes around. And then, so then all of a sudden, as I was doing that, I looped in Rod and Craig, and they went from being, you know, wanting to throw me out the window to actually getting engaged. And they were like, oh no, this shouldn't go over here. That should actually go over here. And so every morning, all of a sudden, it became our ritual that we would, you know, work through this architecture. And at one point, Craig said, holy shit, this is the data schema that, you know, you've just mapped out here on the wall, the data schema, and I've got it all wrong. And so now I have to go back to, you know, re-architecting the database, because this right here is the schema that we need to use. And so that was, again, this you know, a really fundamental moment of using that opportunity through user research. And it is that, you know, I was just over in the States, and I was just meeting with a bunch of people. And it's one of my favorite things, because you know, I was just in the States and these people are guarded. People, you know, are constantly wanting a piece of them, you know, that they're in business and like, oh, what are you selling me? Very on guard. And I was like, can you tell me about how you work? Can you tell me your workflow? I'd love to hear, you know, how do you do this? How do you know, like, that seems hard. You know, how do you make it work? And so getting them to unload on you all their problems is cathartic for them. And it's, you know, absolutely, you know, enlightening and revealing to someone like me that, you know, I get to hear all the things that they're bitching and moaning about, because those are all, okay, that's something that we need to address. That's something we need to fix. And instead of going in with a heavy, I've got a solution for you, I'm going to pitch you my solution, by me listening to their problems and engaging with them and saying, okay, why do you want to do that? Tell me more about why you want to do that. Okay. And how does it connect to this other thing? So really, really getting in their headspace and connecting with them on a very, very meaningful level for them that they care about, that they're passionate about. All of a sudden they're like, so what is it you do? Oh, cool. Oh, interesting. Oh, so that kind of solves my problems. Oh, I see now. Like, oh yeah, can you tell me more about that? And like, can I be involved in some way? And so again, all of a sudden you're forming this relationship, and you're basically doing pre-sales. And you know, that's how we got our first zero customers. I mentioned, you know, people came in and did this user testing. Those were our first zero customers. And they were amazing, amazing customers. And then same thing with Upstock. So our very first user study was, you know, our very first customer. And they are still a customer. They're still an amazing customer. So that's been a really, really integral part of the process. And so for me, one of the things that was important, like when I left Xero, as you said, like it has this great reputation of being a design-led business, and that the design is one of its core competitive advantages. All of that's true, but I still felt that there was just a lot of unfinished business and that I still had things to prove. And so like, why would I go back and, you know, go back into the burning house and of a startup and do another one? It is like I had something to prove, like that this is, I still don't think it's good enough that, you know, the way people have to work with shitty software just makes me so angry and so sad that people are tortured every day by these things. So I have to, you know, I just feel compelled to. And then the other thing was, you know, working with Xero, working with accountants, turning that into fun was absolutely amazing. Like, that was, again, one of these things that I really brought from the marketing side to from a design perspective, and said, all right, how do we flip the narrative? So all of a sudden, we're talking about beautiful business, beautiful accounting software. That's remarkable. That stops you in your tracks. You know, nobody said anything like that. Why is that? What is that? And making, you know, a celebration of business, a celebration of finances, and that it's a party to be enjoyed, and to enjoy the successes and celebrate the successes of building and running businesses. So that was this amazing kind of really uplifting the industry, both, you know, the technology and that transforms people's lives, but then also the culture that goes around it. And what's interesting now with Upstock is that, you know, food and beverage, you know, is plenty sexy, plenty fun. You know, that is what it's known for. But it's not known necessarily for being operationally, you know, sound and well-run, well-managed. You know, lots of hospital outlets really do it for the passion and do it for the love and for the celebration and the party. And so if we can bring in this element of, okay, we're going to automate this. Again, click of a button. One of my favorite business concepts and design concepts is well over 100 years old. It's Eastman Kodak. So when George Eastman invented the Kodak camera, you know, at the time, to take a photograph, you had to be a scientist. You had to be like a chemist that, you know, worked with very dangerous chemicals, and you had to, you know, be a physicist that knew how to, you know, lenses worked and how light works and, ambient light and exposures onto these plates. And all of a sudden, Eastman was able to do that, put it in a tiny little black box or a brown, it was called a Brownie camera. And their slogan was, you push the button, we do the rest. So you expose the film and then we will, you know, you send it in. You know, you talked about that photomat example just a minute ago. That was absolutely fucking revolutionary. Like, you know, that you could get it in an hour. It didn't take days of a chemist, you know. And so that idea, you push the buttons and it just happens automatically, is, and then, you know, the next version of that was the Polaroid camera, which instantly you have a photo in your hand. And the next version of that was Instagram, where you have the photo not only in, you know, instantly available, but instantly available to the entire human population across the globe. And so those are those, you know, I'm always looking for that magic. What is that? Like, you click a button and it, you know, the software magically does everything else. And it's really interesting, obviously, now in the age of AI, how much of that is going to come online and how transformative that's going to be.
We were speaking about that.
We were just talking about that in the previous pod we recorded this morning. And one of the guys was showing us how he uploaded a PDF. It's a ChatGPT plugin, and you just put the PDF in and it turns it into a 2-minute video, like with a full, perfectly matched Shutterstock B-roll AI voiceover that beautifully articulates or summarizes. It's just, there's just one click, you know, it's not even, there's no code, no nothing. I find this whole area, it's so much that we can unpack here. It reminds me a lot of the Christian Beck story, the guy who founded LawConnect. You know, he spent 10 years working on law firms in Australia and then created LawConnect software, which again is a B2B software, and similar sort of thing. I want someone to figure out hotel check-in to make that so much faster. Every time I turn up, I'm like, you know, I'm fucking coming. I booked 6 months ago and it's like you're giving me the nuclear codes. I just want to go to my goddamn room. There's something for somebody to solve. But I love also how you said, I've got something to prove. And I think, you know, you can have a $25 billion business and you still got something to prove. Us entrepreneurs are just there's something wrong in our head, you know. But that's, you can't put that in somebody. Like, I love looking for people who've got something to prove, and you can't train it. Somebody either has that thing in them where they've got to have it or not. You've still got it. Eric, you were going to say something.
What was the turning point at Xero when you knew, like, we have something here? Like, you got the initial testing, then you're going to market and you're selling. Like, you started in 2006, you were up by 2015. What year and what was that turning point when you guys were like, you know what, you looked at each other and went, you know, we've got a multi, you know, $1 million probably at the time, now obviously a multi-billion-dollar company?
Well, for Rod, it was within the first week he was shopping for a G6. So for him.
Typical entrepreneur. You need that guy there.
Exactly.
Craig and I were much more skeptical, and we were like, either this is going to be a massive flame out or this is going to be a massive success. It's going to be one or the other. And, you know, we approached it, you know, for shits and giggles. That was our attitude, was like, we're just here to have fun, see what we can do, and enjoy the ride. And, you know, I think that was just, I still have that attitude about, you know, Upstock. It's, I'm here to enjoy the ride. I'm building it because I love it and I want to see where we can take it. There were a couple moments where, you know, it became clear to me that this was going to be big. And one of them was, I was hiking in the woods near my house. There's a mountain near my house that, you know, is great on the weekends. And, you know, a bunch of people go up and down it all the time. And I was walking with my wife and kid. And up in front of me, I heard some people talking. And this guy was, he's like, hey, mate. this, you've got to use this platform Xero. It's so amazing. It's transformed my business. Like, it's the easiest thing in the world. I've hated all these other things. You've got to try it. And was just going on and kind of going into detail. And so it's just overhearing that conversation and hearing that like passion for what we're doing and somebody, you know, that moment of word of mouth, you know, you don't often get to hear that. And so that was amazing. And then, you know, hearing kind of the feedback that we're getting, you know, our goal, you know, one of my goals was to make it sexy, to make it fun, to make it addictive. And Twitter launched exactly the same time that we did. And so it was this really interesting thing where, you know, we were watching this commentary about what we're doing in real time that we, you know, weren't really prompting or provoking. And to see people just spontaneously sharing that they love what we're doing and that they're using those words, that it's sexy, that it's fun, that it's addictive. You know, that was this moment. Again, this is, you know, you're getting to witness word of mouth, be privy to these conversations. And the same thing, you know, I'm experiencing. So there's kind of this cult-like fanaticism, and that's, you know, exactly what we're seeing and experiencing with Upstock, which is, again, this really thrilling moment where we went to an event a couple years ago, and, you know, we had a booth, and we thought, hey, we have this great solution. Everybody's going to want it. It's like going to change, you know, the industry. And nobody gave a shit. Like, we had to literally, I was pulling people in, and, you know, and it's pretty humbling. You know, you've built this, you know, mega billion-dollar company, and I'm hawking my wares at a trade show. And so, but it is, that is actually the fun bit, though. Like, you're getting to, you know, face-to-face time. You're, again, building something from nothing. I still can't believe that we had the audacity to, like, go from nothing to, you know, how do you get started? How do you even, you know, create something? And so, you know, pulling these people as they walk by and just dragging them in, and they were like, yeah, I don't know. I don't, like, whatever. I don't care. And then 2 years later, we went to the same event, and I was all geared up. I'm telling the team, look, you're going to have to go in there, and you're going to have to be ready to pull people in. It's going to be ugly, but we just, you know, this is how things are done. And this time around, half the conference was already customers of ours, which was already like, oh shit, like, wow, we're further along than I had really calculated. And then when I went around to meet with our customers, I walked in on these conversations where they're like, oh, this is Upstock. Are you on Upstock? You need to be on Upstock. This is like changed my world. And people were coming over to our booth and saying, oh my God, we're a remote team. So we don't really meet with people directly that much. So they wanted to meet us in person. And it was, again, this kind of like cult fandom thing that really threw me off, because I was expecting just the opposite. And, you know, we did not, it was just the opposite. We were flooded with people into our booth, and me and you with the Australian food tech company, they were next to us, and they're like, what have you done? Like, all anyone can talk about is you guys. And so again, that was a moment with Upstock, where it's like, okay, we are now kind of crossed over into this space where when you see that much passion in customers, that they are just fizzing and telling people about it, and you can't stop them, then that's a real telltale sign.
When did you start Upstock, and what are some of the, can you share any kind of high level numbers with us, just in regards to, yeah, clients or revenue or what you've been raising?
And also funding. Yeah. I'd be interested in the funding. Yeah. The raising side.
Yeah. So, in terms of when we started, I turned 50 in 2019, and for my 50th birthday, I went to Bali for a month. And right after that, we kind of started forming the team, and we started planning out what we're going to do. And by January 2020, we had an MVP, something that we could put in front of people to start selling. And we got our very first customer that first, I told you about how we did user research with this customer. Once we showed them the MVP, they were like, we'll sign up right now. Absolutely. They became a customer immediately. And, you know, we really thought, okay, here we go. This is, you know, this is easy. And we're just off to the races now. At the same time, there were these ominous news stories all of a sudden emerging in the press about this thing out of Wuhan that was, you know, starting to spread and was potentially something big. And Duncan and I, our plan was to bootstrap, you know, that we would kind of, we would build it ourselves and we were going to do lean, mean, you know, that we were going to do it very differently to what we did with Xero, which was raising quite a bit of money. And Xero, for instance, that's a whole other story, but we IPO'd a year after we founded the business. And so with Upstock, yeah, the idea was to do it, you know, much more guerrilla, much more bootstrapped. And then as all of a sudden, this just cascade of news stories about this pandemic that was emerging, we realized, all right, we're going to have to weather a storm here. And to do that, we're really going to need to raise some money. So we started going through our network and both through VCs and through, you know, our personal contacts. We knew that we're doing investing and started putting the word out that we were raising money. And so by that point, by the time that we actually started, and, you know, actually right after we started, we got VCs contacting us immediately, again, because, you know, we had reputation and had contacts. And we were saying no to them. And then all of a sudden we were like, well, and so lockdown happened. And that's when we actually started, you know, raising money in earnest. So really going around pitching, except not going around, just sitting in front of a, you know, camera like this. And that was actually such a blessing because, you know, the old way, that was, if there's one thing that came out of COVID that, thank God, is that you no longer have to go, you know, shopping, peddling your wares, you know, door to door, like a, you know, you know, doing a dog and pony show for every VC and have to go to their office, schmooze them, do the whole, you know, kind of drinks and dinner and, you know. It was much more, you could just go bang, 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 you know, a bunch of calls back to back and, you know, take a breather in between at home. And so we raised $3.5 million, you know, within 6 months of getting that first customer. And we, you know, hospitality was shut down. So it was, you know, quite a feat to be able to raise that money and also to, you know, we were still growing customers and we were still growing the activity on the platform, but it was, you know, obviously much, much, much slower than we had projected, but it did give us time to flesh out some features. So we started out just doing the supply side. So for suppliers to manage orders from their customers. And then in that time, in that downtime of COVID, we built the buy side. And so it was actually in a lot of ways gave us that focus and kind of we got speed out of that. And obviously, you know, digital tools became, you know, much more front and center and talked about, you know, in every business across the world and particularly in supply chains. And so that definitely helped build awareness in general. And we were really lucky in New Zealand that our lockdown didn't last that long and that we could resume trading. And so hospitality opened, but, you know, in relatively limited ways. So we were born under, you know, dark, dark, dark clouds and with these massive headwinds the entire way. So at first it was COVID, then it was supply chain, you know, issues that were just ground to a halt, a lot of our customers. And trade in general. And then in New Zealand, we had a whole bunch of weather events that really took out a bunch of customers on the platform, wiped out their businesses, and then, you know, the recession / inflation. So we've known nothing but hard times, but yet we've managed to grow the business exponentially year on year, you know, from the very beginning. And we're really proud of it. So we are the, you know, the dominant player in New Zealand. We have one itsy bitsy little competitor here, and then one from Australia that, you know, again, they're really minor and kind of insignificant. In Australia, there's a bunch of competitors that have actually been around a lot longer than we have, and that have raised three times as much money as we have. So we've raised $13 million. They've raised, you know, 40 in the neighborhood of $40-45 million Australian. So we've been, you know, our competitors, we've heard from them directly telling us how that we are a small but mighty team that, you know, with minimal resources relative to them, both in terms of cash and team, we've, you know, really put up a very, very formidable competitor to them. And so, you know, we're doing extremely well in Australia, and, you know, we have customers in the US as well. And we're kind of, you know, there's a lot of lessons we took from Xero about entering the US and what not to do. And so we're being very mindful about how we enter the US.
I don't want to go too deep, because I think there's a whole pod or two you could talk about just with Upstock, but they're, I have huge respect for people who can build marketplaces, because they're so tough, right? Like, we're trying to build two, they're only valuable when both sides are there, right? Like, so you got to be building two businesses which have two different paths to market and nuances to get into and stuff. But I assume, and am I correct in assuming that if you get the restaurant, then the restaurant then says to their suppliers, right, guys, you got to get on here because I want to buy. Is that how it works? Is it, do they do a lot of the outreach for you?
Like, that definitely was what actually really appealed to us about it, was the fact that there was a flywheel built into this. And we, you know, we experienced flywheel dynamics at Xero with accountants recruiting their small businesses. But, you know, we felt like we had an advantage with Upstock, where the small businesses with Xero only had one accountant, where a hospitality business has 10, 20 suppliers they work with. So they'd be able to, you know, do a lot more recruiting for us. And that definitely has been the case. And so it's been interesting, though, how, you know, we did expect the hospitality side to be more of a driver of things. And, you know, the painful reality is that hospitality businesses are not very operationally minded. And so, again, I've mentioned this, that there are more passion projects. And so, you know, you try to talk to them about operations and there really isn't a huge interest or appetite in that. There are some, there are definitely some, and they tend to be the restaurant groups that are running multiple operations. And so they are the ones that will be more interested. But even in those cases, I've been pretty shocked and disappointed how, especially with digital tooling and workflows, that they don't optimize that to the extent that they could, nearly to the, you know, to the extent that they could. And so that helped us quite a bit, getting those early hospitality customers on. But it's actually, you know, our primary business is with the suppliers, and the suppliers, you know, tell their customers, you need to be, you know, if you want to order from us, this is the platform that you need to order from. And there really is almost no resistance to that. There are, you know, a few holdouts, and, you know, we have, again, using AI. So this has been really phenomenal. We can convert any type of order, whether it's a phone call or an email or a text or a PDF or a PO, and turn that into an order and a digital order. So they don't actually need to be on the platform. And that's been a really, that was going into it, what it was a really key thing for us, that, you know, in the industry lingo, it's, you know, single player mode versus multiplayer mode, that you did not need, you could operate under single player mode. And most platforms, it's the other way around, that that the single player mode is the default and multiplayer is kind of the benefit, where ours, as in a marketplace, multiplayer is the default, and actually getting a single player version is the more challenging bit. And so that was, you know, key to us getting that early traction, was making it so that any business could use it without having to recruit and force it on their trading partners.
Mm.
So that was definitely kind of a secret to our early success.
Philip, we've run out of time. We're already up well over the hour. Man, like, this has just been phenomenal. I'd love to have you back at another time if you have any space to do a calendar, because it has been genuinely fascinating listening to you. I can see Mark's blown away, and I am too. We speak to a lot of people, but there's just no accounting for experience, and we really appreciate it. I have one parting question. Why are you in New Zealand? Like, I see this on the weekend at Coldplay. I was sitting next to some people who are from the States who are editing the film down at Weta Studios. They're doing Minecraft, the film. And I see these really talented people from all over the world in New Zealand, and New Zealand just punches so far above its weight with talent. Why did you, as a former American, was it just to build that business, or were there other reasons you relocated to this part of the world?
Have you looked at the news recently?
Okay, that's what I was wondering. So basically, you just saw, I like the life in New Zealand.
Yeah, I mean, so there were a number of factors. George Bush got elected, and that was absolutely a huge factor. Columbine had just happened, and we just had our first kid. That was a huge factor. And then, you know, the dot-com bubble burst, and we wanted to go see, experience other parts of the world and see if there's some other places that are less consumer driven, less racist, to be quite frank, less kind of, you know, just pure capitalistic societies. And New Zealand, you know, really was this amazing place that we found that is still capitalistic, still, you know, and in fact is really embraces it and makes it really easy to set up companies here. That was the other thing. Like, the bureaucracy in the U.S. is just it's just inconceivable. Like, what if you talk about sales tax, just a little thing, like, so that's for us, you know, doing accounting in the States with sales tax that goes across federal, state, county. Within one building, you can have multiple different tax jurisdictions. Yes. In a single building. So it's bonkers. And so things like that, you know, there's a culmination of many things, and just stunningly beautiful place. You know, when I got here, 9/11 had just happened, and it was a pretty intense time in the U.S. And I came here, and it was just this amazing place. And it reminded me of California before anybody showed up. So it's like this virgin California that you, again, I get to write the rules. I get to invent it. I take it from zero to one. You know, that I love those things, like being able to make the rules and create something magic and special. So, and that's what I found here in New Zealand. And the talent, the caliber of talent here was astounding. I was really, really, really surprised and impressed. It is that kind of generalist, you know, they call it number 8 wire, you know, mindset, where, you know, you have to be able to do everything. And that, again, that fits, as you described me, that fits perfectly with my mindset and, you know, the type of people that I like to work with.
Yeah, I'm glad I asked the question. I watched the McLaren documentary recently when I was on a plane, and another great Kiwi. A lot of people don't know that, you know. Yeah, McLaren is actually from New Zealand.
Yeah.
An incredible documentary story if you have not seen it. I think it's a lovely reminder to hear somebody from the US, because we idolize anyone from America, really, in this parts of the world that has chosen Australia as its home. And it was, New Zealand, Australia, this part of the world. When I was there, you know, just sitting there, and the guy was from the States with his wife, and he just said, we love, love, love New Zealand. What Peter Jackson set up down there at Weta Studios is world-class. And I couldn't agree more. There's so much talent in that little, beautiful little country. We got married there, I was telling you, before we were old, because we love New Zealand so much. And We just thank you for your time, Philip. We'd love to have you back sometime in the future for round two.
Thank you. We really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I can't wait to see what you do with Upstock, mate. Like, it's going to be super exciting. And definitely, guys, go check out upstock.app. I've got a few mates who own a bunch of restaurants, so I'll be making sure they're on the app. But go check it out. You can see Philip's handiwork there. His fingerprints are all over it. The UI is beautiful. We really appreciate your time. So, Philip, thank you very much, mate. We'll see you sometime around the traps, I'm sure. If you're ever over this way, please, if you want to come by our studios here, we'd love to have you come and sit in front of our boxing kangaroo and talk more about entrepreneurship. Thanks very much. All right, everybody else, guys, you know what to do. Like, subscribe, drop a comment. I'm sure Philip will read them. Let him know what you think of the content. It helps us get more entrepreneurs like Philip on the show. So appreciate it. Share it. That's the best thing you can do. Share the news that the podcast exists. Thanks very much, guys. We'll see you on the next one.
Hey there. I hope you enjoyed that episode of Unemployable. If you'd like to watch another episode, just click there.